We are back on the record in the matter of Hazel Hurst versus the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, case number 03654. Respondent, to present your case, would you call your first witness, please?
We'd like to call Dr. Robert Rust.
Dr. Rust.
Good morning, Dr. Russ.
Good morning. Oh, wrong one? This one here?
Yes.
Good morning.
Excuse me, ma'am. I just asked one thing to begin. Both Mr. Hazelhurst Sr. and I had a little trouble hearing the questions. You can remember to keep your voice up to the extent you can remember.
Thank you.
I will. Could you please state your name for the record?
Dr. Robert Rust.
And what is your current position?
I'm the Director of Child Neurology and Director of the Child Neurology Training Programs, Co-Director of the Epilepsy and Child Neurology Clinics at the University of Virginia.
And Dr. Rust, you were present for the testimony yesterday of Dr. Corbier, is that correct?
Yes, I was.
Is there any credible evidence that the MMR vaccine causes autism?
No, ma'am.
This hypothesis has been well studied, hasn't it?
Yes, ma'am, it has.
And could you please tell us about the studies that are out there that discuss the MMR vaccine?
Have I meant to have both of them? There are a number of studies of varying quality that have tried to make a correlation between various factors that can include relationship to the time of vaccination. That's really most of the evidence involves that. But that sort of evidence needs to be placed within the context of epidemiological studies, and the epidemiological studies have not supported that association.
Is there any credible evidence in peer-reviewed medical literature that MMR vaccine can cause autism?
No, ma'am, not to my knowledge.
Is there any credible evidence that thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause autism?
No, ma'am, not to my knowledge.
And what is the basis for your opinion on that?
The same information, the lack of any kind of epidemiological correlation. There's the additional fact that, especially in consideration of thimerosal, what one needs, of course, in support of such an hypothesis is a reasonable biological explanation, and there is no such reasonable biological explanation, and there have been considerable studies concerning mercury and its toxicity to brain, and they haven't supported that contention either.
Doctor, I'd like to go over your CV, which was filed as Respondent's Exhibit F. Could you briefly describe your educational background, starting with your undergraduate degree?
Undergraduate education was at four separate universities. At the completion of that, did graduate school at the University of Virginia. This was graduate work in history of science, and biology, in particular immunology, and that was followed by several years of teaching in Europe. Then several years of immunological research at the University of Virginia. That was followed by medical school at the University of Virginia, finishing up in 1981. Then trained first in pediatrics at Yale, and then in neurology, child neurology, and neurochemistry at Washington University in St. Louis. Did as well a fellowship in neonatal neurology. On completion of that work, I remained on the faculty at Washington University before taking a position at the University of Wisconsin, where I was the program director and training director in child neurology and director of the cerebral palsy clinic. That was followed by appointment at Boston Children's Hospital, where I was again training director in child neurology, director of the outpatient clinics, among the three co-directors of our intensive care service and other positions during that tenure. I returned to the University of Virginia as a professor of epileptology and neurology, holding the Worrell Chair in those disciplines, as director of child neurology, as I mentioned, and the training program, as well as our outpatient clinic.
And what board certifications do you hold?
I'm board certified in pediatrics and in neurology, with special qualifications in child neurology.
Could you please describe some of the honors and awards you have recently received or in the recent past?
Not usually the kind of thing I say too much about. What would you like to know?
Just maybe a few in the last couple of years.
Well, over the years, I've had quite a few teaching awards. Have had recognition for my research in terms of fellowships and support for research programs. Numerous visiting professorships, and just last Saturday received the Howard Award of the Child Neurology Society.
And what is that award? What is that recognition of?
It's meant to recognize the person who's made the most distinguished contributions to child neurology. It's a yearly award, and somebody selects each year, and this was my year for it. So.
Congratulations, Doctor.
Thank you so much.
Do you serve on editorial boards?
Yes, I've served on quite a few of them. There are, I think, six or seven of them, something like that.
Could you name a couple?
Journal of Child Neurology, Pediatric Neurology, a number of other things over the years.
And are you a reviewer for any scientific journals?
I've provided reviews for, I think, some 20 or 22 different journals over the years.
Could you just name two or three of the journals that you would serve as a reviewer for?
Acta Scandinavica, Neurologica, Lancet Neurology, and all of the North American Child Neurology Journals, Journal of Neurology, Annals of Neurology, those sorts of things.
You've also published approximately 100 peer-reviewed articles, is that correct?
About 50 peer-reviewed articles and about 50 chapters, that's right.
Could you describe your responsibilities at the University of Virginia?
Well, I'm responsible for making sure the child neurology program functions properly, and that we have everybody where they're supposed to be at on time and so forth. Harder for me probably than some others, but for the training of our child neurology candidates, for the child neurological training of our adult neurology trainees, for the neurological training of our pediatricians, for the neurological training of our medical students at all 4 years of their training, I make contributions to that. I'm responsible for our outreach clinics in child neurology, in Virginia, of which we have four. I'm responsible for my own activities as a researcher and as other things, I guess.
So you have a clinical practice in which you see patients?
I have a very busy clinical practice and have had throughout my career.
How many children over the years have you treated with the diagnosis of autism?
I must say I've not counted. They've been seen, of course, in two capacities. One as a person overseeing the training of child neurologists or neurologists or pediatricians, and one as a person seeing patients in the ward service, and as well my own private clinic. I would suspect several hundred patients at least.
And do you diagnose children with autism?
It has become a very common experience to do that, yes.
Why do you believe it's become such a common experience?
It's quite clear to me, based on my own career, that we've become more sensitive to what it is that causes somebody to have that diagnosis. That in the past we may have assigned other diagnoses to patients as especially mental retardation, static encephalopathy, and injury to the brain. Now we know a great deal more about how to sort these things out. For me, over the last 15 years, it's been a considerable interest to make a contribution to understanding the manifestations of children that have autism. One must dig for the diagnosis, ask particular questions, and it generates particular phenotypes or particular appearances that young men particularly, but some young women as well, have, which is consistent with the diagnosis of autism in its several forms.
Have you ever reviewed videos to diagnose or determine when the onset of autism is?
Quite a large number. That's one of the most helpful things for us. We typically make the diagnosis by observation of the child in the clinic, but in order to get to some better understanding of the natural history of autism, we find that videos can be very helpful. We're also called upon to view videos of individuals who haven't yet come to the clinic, or individuals that won't be coming to the clinic because we're consulted by parents who are entertaining the possibility of adopting a child from overseas, and we're meant to try to provide them with the best information they can about the neurological health of that child.
In addition to the testimony of Dr. Corbier, which you heard yesterday, what else have you reviewed in preparation for your testimony today?
I'm pretty widely connected with the literature on this subject, but it's a literature that grows very rapidly, I've provided, I think, several lists of papers that are pertinent, and was asked to pick 10 in particular, which I did, so that's, I think, been provided to everybody.
Have you reviewed the medical records?
Yes, I have, in detail.
The videotapes?
Yes, ma'am. There are many videotapes, and I've reviewed them.
And you've read the report of Dr. Corbier?
Yes, ma'am, and responded to it.
And you responded to that in an expert report that we filed as Respondents Exhibit E. Dr. Russ, petitioners have put forward a hypothesis that thimerosal-containing vaccines cause autism. What is your number one reason that hypothesis will be proven wrong?
That we're coming to some considerable understanding of actually what happens in autism and why this terrible illness develops in children. This has been the progress of the decade of the brain and the very excellent work of a number of developmental neuroscientists. So we're understanding this and other disorders with regard to problems in the working out of a genetic code for the development of the brain.
Pardon me. I'm concentrating very carefully here, and I'm having a little difficulty hearing, and I'm getting a note that there are others in the back who've indicated they're having trouble hearing. We all want to make sure we hear.
I'll try to speak up a little bit more.
Thank you. Is that better, Madam Court Reporter?
Okay. Sometimes I'm told I speak too fast, so feel free to slow me down.
Okay.
Dr. Russ, I'm just going to back up for a second. You've prepared some slides for today, and I apologize, Special Master. We do not have photocopies of these slides for you. We will provide them for you tomorrow and file them.
There are copies for everybody.
That we will have copies for everybody tomorrow and file them as an exhibit. And I'd like to we still don't have a screen, but we will put these slides up on the wall, and if you could just go through a few of them.
I'm just going to ask that as you refer to this, particularly because we don't have the actual copies, if you would make reference to the slide number with your comments as well, please.
And we have slide number one, which is autism pathophysiology. Could you explain what pathophysiology is?
Physiology is the way in which organ systems function in the body, and pathophysiology is the way in which their function is abnormal. It's pertinent to particular diseases, and so we like to be able to sort out how the manifestations that we see in a particular disease are explained by an adequate and sufficiently detailed pathophysiological understanding.
And if you could go through the points that you have on your slide, please.
Well, what we do know about autism, of course, is it's highly age-dependent with regard to its manifestations. It's a collection of clinical entities, some of which have already been explained on the basis of particular single genes, but others that likely involve not only and as well the epigenetic effects of other aspects, especially the sex of a person. And some aspects of pregnancy in some instances. We feel that autism is likely the result of a number of different genetic problems, not all those genes represented in every individual, not all those abnormal genes, but these may provide some subtle differences between patients and certainly provide differences that are not subtle, and that's the time of onset of disease, which is likely the result of a combination of influences. So we know, for example, that there are patients that have manifestations of autism at birth. They must very carefully be sorted out in those patients from other entities, from static encephalopathy, which simply means a patient has had an insult at one time in their development. It's not going to come again, but it leaves its own often tragic footprint on the patient. So it takes some time during the first few months of life to sort that out, and as the child acquires additional skills and as their nervous system develops, we can see what does or doesn't develop in the way in which the programmed development of brain and nervous system should take place. We see another interval then after birth at about 2.5 or 3 months when a good deal more in the way of cortical activity of the brain comes on, and at that point we can see more about a child's activity and interests in response to surroundings. Many of which things are, again, built into the genetic code of the child. It's a curious thing that, in fact, the cortical aspects of brain function are really not online to a considerable extent, or one might say hardly at all online when a child is born, even at full term. So if we see a baby that's had a stroke involving both hemispheres, where virtually all of the neocortex, virtually all of what we call the forebrain, and this is all the parts of the brain that represent the human potentials that we all cherish for our children and for ourselves. Nonetheless, a child born without some two-thirds of the brain oftentimes appears perfectly normal to examination. It's only when at 2.5 or 3 months those cortical centers are meant to take the place of deeper centers in the brain, not only meant to take the place but have no choice but to do so, and the centers that are deeper go offline. That's the point at which we see abnormalities. It's often hard to convince parents and grandparents that their child has such an injury because of that, but then we see that at 2.5 or 3 or 4 months. They're obviously a child's called on to do more things, interact with their surroundings during the second half of the first year of life, and that's a period during which we can see additional changes. And many children to which we give the diagnosis autism have that diagnosis during that first year of life, and these are the babies that can fit into several categories of congenital autism. During the second, am I speaking loud enough?
I think so.
During the second year of life, we see another large and strikingly homogeneous population of patients, of children, with autism, and this is the category that is either a degenerative or acquired form of autism, or a regressive form. It goes under various names, and very typically we see that progression sometime between 12 or 14 and 26 or 27 months. As we look back at those children in terms of gathering additional history, we find that they've already had manifestations of the illness in most instances, so the distinction between the congenital and the regressive form is, in a sense, artificial, because children typically don't have normal language development, typically don't have normal interaction with their surroundings, even if they fit into this acquired form. There are, however, a great many patients that do have a perfectly normal history, so far as we can determine, and then a sudden deterioration. It seems that that's a point at which additional genetic signals have come on board that are meant to take the place of preceding signals. The cortex of the brain and the what we call the fiber pathways. So the cortex consists of the thinking cells and their supportive cells, the neurons and the astroglial cells and other kinds of cells that function together in a very complex way and talk to each other with various pathways. They talk to themselves in the cortical layers in which they find themselves. All of these cells have to migrate from deep into the in the brain to form the cortex, which is the outer part of the brain. So this is as if you have a coating on the brain in which all these cells finally find themselves and talk to one another with an exceedingly complex system of fiber pathways or connections that we call axons and dendrites. Also talk to the layers beneath and talk to the other areas in the cortex. So the cortex is subspecialized. It's a remarkable miracle that these cells arrive where they need to be in most individuals and function in a way that's distinct one area from another to do all the things that we can do. This not only involves single areas but connections between areas. It's exceedingly complicated and coming to be far more well understood than it was even 5 years ago. And then the two sides of the brain have to talk to one another, which they do through large fiber pathways from one side to the other. So we know of neurological syndromes where the disconnection between the two sides of the brain accounts for problems. We know of those where the communication between one or another sub-area of brain is interfered with. And we know of those where the organization of activity, even in the tiny small area where initially the neurologic task is undertaken, in those small areas, things can go wrong with communication as well. This is the understanding of this is proceeding at a remarkable pace with what we need to have in the way of science. We need to have first a hypothesis that makes sense biologically and neurologically, and then we need to have the observations of one group and then another group validating the first group, and then additional points made as we go back to the patient. Or we go to an experimental model to prove that these things, in fact, can be replicated in either circumstance. We usually observe things we hadn't observed before because of what we've learned and then make our understanding of the particular syndromes far more complicated, far more sophisticated, and, in fact, in the long run, far more simplified in that we can fit so many things together. So that is the period that's pertinent to this particular case, but there are other intervals. In little girls with Rett syndrome, they have an additional period of deterioration at 5 or 6 years of age. In children with autism, there's an additional period of deterioration in the teenage years and so forth. There are various other stages. So the general concept, I hope, I've made reasonably understandable. So influenced not only by genes, but by epigenetic influences. These can include environmental influences, usually deprivation being the most important one, where children don't get sensory input, sensory experience. Sex of a child, very important in several different ways. Sex of the parents may be important in the newly understood system of parental imprinting for diseases. So a disease that has some autistic manifestations, Angelman syndrome is one where the effect of one parent's genetic contribution may influence the outcome. The syndromes are highly consistent and readily recognizable. We need only watch the child for a few minutes, typically, to come to some conclusion about whether that child has autism in the second year of life or the first year of life. Rett syndrome is the same thing. And the clinical differences between these are often striking as well, particular ways of dealing with the environment.
I could just interrupt, what is epigenetics?
Well, epigenetics are those influences that that play a role in the working out of what the genes are trying to do, and it can, as I mentioned, be deprivation. It can be a negative influence of something in the environment that can be during the pregnancy. In particular, is a time when, with reference to autism, it's a time during which infections may play a role, and rubella is the classic one. Now, a child with rubella encephalopathy has striking autistic manifestations, but those children differ from other individuals with autism in that they have other abnormalities, other areas that are afflicted by the infection, and so they can be set apart from other kinds of autistic syndromes. The sex of the child or the maternal hormones may also play a role. These are things we're coming to understand better, but this is an area that's what one might call a work in progress.
And when you say environmental influences, do you mean things such as the introduction of toxins?
Yes, it's possible that that toxins may play a role in injuring the developing nervous system. And there are quite a few examples of this. Again, they usually have a particular syndromic appearance. So with reference to mercury, for example, I'll say something more about this. There's a particular appearance of the children that are injured by intrauterine mercury. Unfortunately, because of blood flow to baby and other kinetic considerations, by that I mean other ways in which substance move from one area to another and cross various membranes and become concentrated there. If a mother has considerable amount of mercury in her system, that mercury actually gets concentrated in her fetus, resulting in mother having less of a mercury burden, the child having more. And tragically, when that happens, we do see children that are severely afflicted with manifestations that only superficially resemble autism. In fact, the children have what we call a static encephalopathy with neurological problems and things very different from those in autism that interfere with their communication with their surroundings.
Can autism be caused by a toxic insult?
You can produce, again, a child's interference with surroundings that may appear like autism, but we don't have, in fact, a good example of a toxin that produces something that is the same as the syndrome of regressive childhood autism. I'm not aware of a toxin that produces the phenotype that we, in fact, see.
What are the core features in autism that you would not see in a brain injury that is caused by trauma or toxic insult?
It's a very complex thing, autism in children, and it has the regressive form has its own set of peculiarities that I mentioned are so characteristic from child to child. Children don't have all of them necessarily, but they have very many of them. And these represent probably the preservation to some extent of skills that come online very early for the child and are not replaced by skills that are at a higher level. So with many children who have regressive autism or high-functioning autism, other types of autism, we see things that we have described as splinter skills. We may have a child that has little or no language, or at least little language, who then has astonishing capacity to deal with numbers or to know a great many words in lists. It's likely that that capacity to gain knowledge about lists of things is the way in which we initially learn our language. 95% of children acquire nouns predominantly, so lists and lists of nouns that they can use to name things. We see in autism some individuals who I had a patient who knew every name in a phone book this big. If I asked him the phone number for any patient in that book, he would immediately give it to me very rapidly and in a strange way. So there's a strangeness that accompanies these kinds of skills, and probably because we learn certain kinds of social skills and things as time goes on, and probably part of this is genetically determined and part is experiential. He would give those things to me very rapidly. The idea that because of his capacity to memorize, he might find useful employment was one that we explored, and it did not work out, as it often doesn't, because of the very complex aspects of the strangeness, I guess you might say, associated with autism. Of course, we say strangeness because we're different from the children with autism, and perhaps if they were the dominant group of people, they would think us strange. But nonetheless, it does appear strange, and the quality of strangeness is the way in which we help to make the diagnosis. Parents, if you ask them, does the child do something strange, and they'll give you a list of such things. They're often the same list, and the parents are often gratified by the opportunity of trying to explain these things. They're often taken to task by other parents or cousins or aunts or something else, or people in the supermarket when their child is having difficulties in that setting, and told, why don't you discipline your child more properly or something like that. I provide my parents with a little card that says, you don't have any idea what I'm dealing with here, so please shut up. It's important for the parents to have that kind of support, I think, with my signature on it. The long list includes odd things, children that cover their ears when the vacuum sweeper is turned on, so sensitivity to loud noises. This sets most autistic children apart from those with deafness, who go and hug the vacuum sweeper because they're actually hearing a sound and they're gratified by that. There are peculiarities about eating. Foods are allowed to go to room temperature rather than being hot or cold. There oftentimes is fright related to people wearing masks, to people wearing hats. There are other kinds of things, and it's a long list, and it's not always gathered on every patient, but it does help to demonstrate both the fact that this is likely almost entirely genetically determined, because we have things that are so true from patient to patient, and that's the way in which we can understand those things. Toxic influences or injuries or infections produce a wide variety of changes typically, and that's not what we see in regressive autism. Does that answer your question? I apologize for the lengthy answer.
I believe it does, but what wouldn't you see in a toxic injury that you would see in autism? For instance, in this case, we know from the videotapes and from the testimony on Monday that you weren't here, that Yates knew his alphabet and his numbers, but had no expressive language.
Well, one must be cautious about coming.
Pardon me. I think what might be helpful is if Dr. Rust would address the phenotype first and then distinguish it.
Okay.
Might actually be more helpful if you would address the regressive phenotype first.
That seems right to me as well. I think that's the best way to do it.
Is there another slide that we should?
Yes, there are several. Perhaps if I could go through the slides and then add what needs to be added to it.
That would be fine.
Thank you. The second one. So the features of classic or regressive autism, as I mentioned, the classic type are those children that were improperly characterized a long time ago by Bruno Bettelheim as being children that didn't respond to their surroundings because of mother not raising them properly, the so-called refrigerator mother. It's an example of the many blind alleys and inappropriate and injurious ways in which the understanding of autism has worked its way out over the last 40 or 50 years. But Kanner described these children who from very early on are not normally responsive to their surroundings. This is meant to be set apart from the regressive form, but as I mentioned, as we look back at videotapes of children that can be said to have suddenly regressed, we find features that are not typical for children in many. So there is, I mentioned it, both of them at the same time, because there is an overlap between these two things. But even with the regressive type, you have this second phase of regression taking place. So the onset is typically before 3 years of age. It typically is between about 15 and 24 months, but the broader interval would be something like 12 months to 28 months typically. These children have severe verbal and nonverbal language impairment, and to speak with it with regard to the current situation, one must be careful again about making judgments based on videotapes rather than on, I guess they're not videotapes, but CDs or whatever they are, rather than seeing the child and doing the kinds of things we do to confirm the diagnosis. But in viewing the videotapes in this instance, language development was abnormal prior to 12 months, at least based on what I saw in the videotapes. There may have been something that was not captured. But not only expressive language, but the kind of language we provide in the way of facial expression. This young man didn't have the typical array of facial expressiveness that one sees in normal children at 12 months. And based on the kinds of tasks the child's meant to do, whether being with other people or whether being videotaped himself. facial expression, again, was not normal. There were only a few smiles, even at 13 and a half months, the child was still using utterance such as which is an utterance that extinguishes typically at about 7 or 8 months in 75% of individuals as they replace that kind of utterance with other things with their first word. So we see that fairly frequently. But then there's a fairly sudden, sometimes overnight and sometimes over weeks, regression that children experience where the child really changes remarkably and where parents tell us that they it's not the same child that they had before. Likely, as I mentioned, this is because of replacement with of more primitive systems of wiring with more sophisticated systems of wiring and some things going offline, but the pattern is fairly consistent. And so it's language impairment, it's social impairment, restricted interests, and repetitive behaviors. Those are the things that are part of this syndrome. The kinds of repetitive behaviors that we look for typically at the outset are limitations in play, where a child may tap at a drum, for example, and seem not to be paying attention to it for an interval and then go off to do something else, may use objects inappropriately, may pick up small toys and run them back and forth on the carpet, which is a quite typical behavior. A little bit later on, typically, but sometimes quite early, flapping activities, spinning activities, and so forth come on as well. So those are that's the syndrome that we're talking about here. If I could have the next one.
Thank you. Before we leave, the reference that you just made was to slide number 2. To proceed.
Thank you, Special Master.
Dr. Ron, slide number 3.
As far as heritability is concerned, although, again, all the details aren't worked out, this is strikingly one of the most heritable severe neurological disorders that we're aware of. It may occur on the basis of quite a long list of genes at least being isolated. This is still something of a work in progress, but the concordance between identical twins is quite high, between siblings, reasonably high risk also for autism, unfortunately. With the fraternal twins or with the siblings of a first child with autism, there's a risk of something between 10 and 27% for some kind of autistic syndrome. This needn't necessarily be classic or aggressive autism. It may be other things that fit within this general framework, high-functioning autism being one of them, probably certain kinds of OCD. What we call the autistic spectrum, is not as well defined or refined as we really need for it to be, and this is the reason that we go to such painstaking detail to get all of the characteristics either prior to the child coming to us or when they come to us. So we have a list of some 40 things that we want to know about. The reason for this is we want to make sure that we're not jumping to conclusions. A great deal of jumping to conclusions regarding behavior of humans has been made in medicine and science for a long time, and that includes the last 20 years. And so people do make long lists of those that are said to have this or that label in terms of their behavior, and this needs to be carefully worked out. But it does appear as if features such as anxiety, features such as restriction in the interest, and so forth are part of families with children with autism, and it's not known yet whether this is a combination of the genetic problems, whether it's what people call gene dose, meaning the amount of that gene that's expressed in the child, because genes are turned on and off in the developmental process, and it may account for some things coming on earlier than others. The best evidence for this is related to Rett syndrome, where we now see a very wide set of diseases that go under that heading of Rett syndrome. The point is that it's clear that there is a heritable aspect to this that is quite striking and supports the idea that the chief abnormality, and probably the abnormality sine qua non, the thing that has to be there, is a genetic defect, and other things are not necessary for it to express itself in that way. So the risk of classic autism in siblings is 20 to 50 times higher than it is in the general population. As I mentioned, it's a highly heritable condition. I could go on to the next one.
Yes,
And we're looking at slide 4.
So this is one example of a gene that's of great importance, because this, as with so many other genes, there are incredible numbers of genes that contribute to the making of our brains and our nervous system. And these genes account for the extraordinary things that we can do with our brains. And this is one of great importance. It codes for a protein that initiates some cascades of cellular development. There are plenty of others that do this, and probably plenty of others that account for autism. But this one is particularly an interest to people now because of its contributions perhaps to several different diseases or several different kinds of things in the body. So cascades of signaling take place where one gene turns on and another, and signals multiply themselves. You make material in the cell that moves to other parts of the cell, that talk to other parts of the cell, and with this you get cells that multiply and become more specific and more sophisticated themselves. So there's replacement, for example, of neurons with other neurons, and replacement of connections of neurons with each other. And this, in fact, continues through the first 3 decades of life, at least. And in fact, some of this takes place in adults as well. So it's cells that multiply, they grow connections with other nerves, touch them, and talk to each other. This is becoming a more complex thing in science as time goes on. They differentiate over time. They may remove some of the connections and replace them with others. And this may have something, it probably has something to do with environmental influences. So this becomes an epigenetic phenomenon as well. If you don't lose a portion of the, you use a portion of the system, you may lose its function. This is exemplified by a young lady in 1956 who was seen at UCLA, whose parents had shut her in a closet for the first 11 years of her life, with only a tiny crack of light showing and the opening of the door to bring her food. And her visual system developed improperly, and she had manifestations that were suggestive of an autistic syndrome, probably because the experience was necessary for the system to develop properly, and therefore did not take its opportunities to develop. And so we have that kind of acquired epigenetic effect as well. The patients, the young children that have the CC phenotype of this have a markedly increased risk for autism. So that's a question of gene dose. They've got 2 copies of an abnormal gene and get more autistic manifestations. Next one, Dan.
And Dr., if I can just interrupt, could you define how you are using the term environmental?
Environmental refers to everything that a person experiences from the time of conception. It includes all those things that take place in the womb and thereafter, which do influence our development and do influence the way in which we function. Some of those influences are transient in the sense that if we have something bad happen and become depressed, we're generally able to snap out of it and move on to something else. With enough of those events, some people find it more difficult to recover. But there are some kinds of genetic influences, as I mentioned with the little girl at UCLA, that if the opportunity for a system to come online and to what happens probably in the brain is the same thing that you or I do when we learn something. If we want to learn the piano, we can't learn it without sitting at the keyboard. We have to sit there and practice and learn things. And the nervous system lays down tracks to do this. So if you learn to play a piece of music well, the system then takes it offline in the neocortex and places it online in the cerebellum in the back of the brain, so that people that learn a song reasonably well find if they try to think about what they're doing, instead of allowing the cerebellum to be on autopilot, they stop and can't play and have to go back somewhere and start over again. So the pattern has been transferred to another part of the brain. This is what happens with all of the automatic tasks that we learn. If somebody practices the piano more and more and becomes a professional, the cortex comes back online so that people can, in fact, pay attention to what they're doing because additional connections have been made. So experience and environment in those ways modifies what we do. And it's a very important thing that is one of the few tools we have for children with autism, where we're trying to make them as functional as possible to find the right way to approach the things that they know about and can do and make connections to other things. This idea has been around for 150 or more years. Madame Montessori put it best when she said, our job is to find the little glowing embers and to blow on them and make them burn brighter, and that's what we try to do with children with autism. And we're trying to make connections in new areas so that they can function better.
So, Doctor, you're not using the word environmental in the same way Dr. Corbier is using environmental factors.
I believe he used it in the setting of exposure to toxins or potentially toxic substances or potential things that potentially cause inflammation. That is part of the environment, but it's a very tiny part and not, in fact, pertinent to this particular set of diseases.
Thank you.
The next one.
And we are looking at pathology of classic regressive autism, slide 5.
So the next step for the neurologist, once we've defined something clinically, is to see where it is in the brain. We do this on examination by finding things that are wrong and knowing where they are in the brain and seeing whether they all seem to be in the same location. That's where we start. For a very long time, we've then looked at the brain itself when the opportunity arises to see what we can find in the way of abnormalities. And in fact, with autism, this opportunity is there. And very important pathological analyses have been performed on children with autism, most especially the work that Dr. Bowman started back in the late 80s with Dr. Adams and others in Boston, and identified by making very thin sections through entire brains that the critical pathological change in autism is in a structure called the amygdala, which sits deep in the brain and is a very, very complex organ that connects what we call the limbic system. This is the part of our brain that has to do with fight and flight and strong emotions, sexual activity, other kinds of things. It's the thing that motivates us, I suppose, the most. And the amygdaloid complex is now known to have something to do, in fact, with alertness, of great importance to know about that. It connects with the basal forebrain and with the forward parts of the brain, which, as they mature, provide us with ideas about what we ought to do and restraints on what we do. It connects with the thinking portions of the cortex, with slower connections with the thinking portions. This, we think, somehow explains that particular disease that we all run into, whether for ourselves or others, called adolescence, during which these connections are just maturing and people are a little more impulsive and more likely to be swayed by emotion, perhaps, than later on. Older adults are not immune to that either. But the amygdala seems to be the critical place here. And then selective changes in what the amygdala connects to. And this is an extraordinarily beautiful part of working out of the pathology of this condition, because in the brain, these exceedingly complex connections through 5 layers of neurons, one to another, and to other portions of the same side and other side of the brain and brainstem into the body, all of these things organize themselves into many columns. These are areas of columnar structure talking to each other in a particular portion of the brain and to other many columns laterally and to other parts of the brain. In looking at these many columns, there are particular areas. Autism is not a condition that can happen anywhere in the brain. It happens in very specific parts of the brain, as I've said here. And this dysgenesis is found in brains of children, of people with autism. We see not only the column itself being abnormal and its connections being abnormal, but thickness of the cortex over it may be larger than it ought to be. And then the thing that you wouldn't necessarily think to be true but is true is the abnormal tissue is actually thicker than it ought to be. When we cause injury to a tissue, we make it smaller because we cause cellular elements to be disrupted and killed. In this instance, it's larger. And during brain development in the first year, and a half of life, lots of areas of the brain become larger than they will be in time because they've got all those recruited neurons that are excited about doing something and are not yet connected with each other. And once they do connect, some are eliminated. And so this enlargement becomes something that's smaller and more compact, very much like the way in which electronic devices have become smaller. I reckon you could say that first they were huge and didn't do very much, and then they become smaller and more technical and do a great deal. These are very specific changes of dysgenesis that are found, and especially it involves connections that we call GABAergic, I apologize for all the technical terms, but there are no others to take their place. But what I can say about the GABAergic system is that this is a system that controls things and makes some things that we don't want to happen less likely to happen. And with these particular what we call synapses, connections taking place in the brain, this controls things like epilepsy and convulsions and abnormal electrical surges in the brain. So in a sense, it's kind of like the way in which we control electrical systems with different insulation and other kinds of corrections. This likely accounts for the very common problem in autism of abnormalities of EEG that we see in an overwhelming number of children with autism, usually not associated with epilepsy until later on in life. And again, that has to do with the working out over time of vulnerabilities to dysfunction. These changes are identified in specific areas of brain pathologically, especially in some frontal areas and in the several portions of the temporal lobe. I can show you a picture of those in a moment. But what we see in the brain itself is underneath the cortical margin, which is the outside of the brain, underneath it is an inner layer and an even more inner layer. And it's the inner layer that becomes too large and too thick and too unwieldy and doesn't do its job quite right. And the layer under that that tends to do its job appropriately, even though there are some problems that we can see when we look clinically at patients. So this volume increases. This is a characteristic thing. It's characteristic of particular brain regions. So again, the idea that autism can happen because of injury anywhere in the brain is quite wrong, and persons who would maintain that position perhaps don't look carefully at patients. I can't say. The inner bridging area, which is this inner area, looks more normal. And again, these changes are in specific areas of the brain. If I could have the next one. I lost track of the number, I'm afraid. So I'm afraid I don't have a pointer. I perhaps should. Does anybody have a pointer? I could walk over there. Is that permitted in the court?
We don't have a microphone.
Oh, I see. Well, let me try to describe it.
And we're looking at slide number 6, Doctor.
Okay. You can see this brain, it looks like a cauliflower. This is what brains look like when you cut through them. It's been cut through in a coronal plane here. And as you can see, as in every brain almost, there are these areas in the middle that have a water-like substance in them that's perfectly normal to have. We need to have that. On the outer side of this, you can see that grayish area. That's the cortex of the brain. And that's, again, where all the thinking cells find themselves. There's a slightly lighter subcortical layer, throughout that cortex are all these layers that I talked about, of very, very carefully arranged connections of neurons. Then, as you see in the fronds of this thing, you see something that's a little brighter white, these little fingers of white matter that go into the gray matter, and that's the outer white matter layer, and underneath that is the inner white matter layer. And it's that outer layer that represents the problem together with the cortex that leads to autism with very specifically distributed abnormalities. There are other kinds of brain problems that can lead to difficulties in all these areas, but they don't look like this clinically, and they don't look like this pathologically. This is a specific entity. If I could have the next one.
And this is slide number 7.
So pathologically, these are the cell losses that occur, and they're in highly selected areas in the brain, and these tend to be what we call evolutionarily advanced architecture of the brain, things that our species and other species have learned over time. These happen perhaps by chance or by intent of some kind we don't understand, and as they develop, they get retained because they provide advantages. And these are the particular frontal associational areas that seem to be involved. These are the areas that are involved with recognition and appreciation of certain kinds of things, recognition of faces being a very important one, retention of that memory of faces. This is also probably epigenetically determined as well, because women have a tendency to take, it's quite striking when you study it carefully, normal women take inventories of what they see and retain that information in relationship to the environment. Men can walk into the same environment and not retain the slightest idea of what they've just seen. I don't think I need to convince you of that. There is a tendency, on the other hand, for even perfectly normal men to have restricted interests, and I don't think I need to convince you of that one either. This has to do with the important male theory of brain with regard to autism and perhaps some aspect of the effects of testosterone and other things on brain development very early on and not later may have something to do with that. I mentioned, again, that these terms are big and fancy, but dysplastic meaning improperly formed and axodendritic meaning the cell body of the neuron and its connections to other kinds of cells have either axons or dendrites, long connections we call axons and shorter connections we call dendrites that cause the system to communicate. I want to point out very particularly that not only are these specific areas that I've mentioned here, and it's hard to remember these things, but these are the areas, amygdala, M1, V1, frontal associational areas, superior frontal gyrus, and other areas, but the areas don't matter so much as saying this is very particular. It's not what you see if somebody has mercury or if somebody has some other arsenic or any other kind of toxin. It's not what you see after encephalitis. It's not what you see after acquired brain injury. This cannot be the way it is without having its basis in a developmental process. There's no other way in which this inducted change, things touching one another and having the first events take place, the only possible way in which this can take place is by the unraveling of genetic code. You lose large pyramidal neurons, and I'll emphasize it's the large ones, the things that used to be called Betz cells and other kinds of things, but it's these very large ones, and you lose some small neurons in the limbic system, and that's the thing I told you about that has to do with emotion and connection with our surroundings in an emotional way. You lose these GABA projections. This is what I talked about in terms of something that exhibits some control over the system. So may have something to do with outbursts that are seen in individuals with or without autism because they can't always exhibit the equanimity that's necessary. We must be very careful about this because individuals with autism are individuals. They are people like everybody else and are subject to emotions like everybody else and must be subject to frustrations based on the limitations that's placed on communication and other kinds of things. We don't fully understand it, but we do see those kinds of outbursts. And very importantly, a quite significant loss of what we call Purkinje cells. These are in the cerebellum, the back of the brain, the coordination part of the brain. It does other things. It has to do with language and music and other kinds of things. It's a very important center. But those cells are lost specifically, very characteristically. So this is the pathology, highly characteristic, so that a person who cut through the brain in these serial sections could identify the disease on the basis of the pathology, not by necessarily looking at the patient to come to that conclusion. Next slide.
We're looking at slide number 8.
So the results we can begin to sort out, and this is what we do in neurology. We try to gather information that makes sense and is proven. We put that together then to go back to the person with the disease and find out what they have that can be explained in that way. And in doing that, we try to find ways in which we can make things better. There are plenty of things we don't understand. There are plenty of things we don't even know the pathology of. But these kinds of observations help us to find ways to treat individuals. And maybe we'll come to the point at which salvage of these pathways with genetic treatment might be undertaken. So reduction of functional boundaries in the many columns reduced these association and integrative capacities so that this, I believe, explains very convincingly the fact that an individual with autism may, in a restricted area, become very interested in that problem and acquire enormous facility with that particular thing. There's oftentimes a repetitiveness to that, and it's something we can take advantage of therapeutically. Music being a very important preserved area in children with autism and adults with autism, where we can use this as a calming effect and use this as something that a person enjoys and something that a person gains greater sophistication with over time. It's a way of communicating. It's guerrilla warfare in all of our patients, but this is a particular kind of guerrilla warfare where we're trying to do something better. But this is what's lost, the integrative part of it, where things cannot be made to have the same response that perhaps a person that a person with this preserved architecture might have. So excitement over play and activity, losing interest in one and moving on to another in a systematic way are things we don't see in autism, And it's almost certainly the result of this loss of integrative capacity. That doesn't mean there aren't other strengths, and one of our jobs as neurologists is finding the strengths of our patients as well as their deficits. Reduced higher level conceptual capacity is a characteristic of autism. In patients with high functioning autism, it's oftentimes the conceptual understanding of the other person. We don't fully understand the child with autism, and autistic patients with autism don't necessarily understand the social context as readily as we do. And so in patients with high functioning autism, you may see patients that get very close to other people in their face, as we call it, not understanding that important boundary, who may not appreciate how another person is thinking about things. And this is a spectrum that falls into the normal population, and we've all observed people who don't have other features of autism but who just don't get it as far as the other person's point of view is concerned. And it may be that there, and I think there's excellent psychological information to suggest this is more of a problem in men than in women, looking at normal populations of men and women. But there's probably something that's right about people who jump to conclusions at the right time as compared to those who wait and think about it longer. All right, so there's a reduced conceptualization, as I mentioned, abnormal sensitivity to certain stimuli, and this is so characteristic that we almost always have the report, as I mentioned, that a child will cover their ears at certain loud noises, that a child will have difficulty with certain kinds of sensory stimulation, mixed textures that they're eating in foods. They'll have other kinds of sensory experiences that others don't have, waving hands in front of the eyes, or even feeling the hands move. A child with autistic movements of the hands usually doesn't look at them, but has that as we don't understand why, but it's so characteristic. And then increased risk for seizures or for paroxysmal outbursts of behavior, which come on very early in autism, unfortunately. Next one. So this is
slide number 9.
This is the architecture we're talking about. It's quite beautiful and complex, and this doesn't even do justice to it, with the overlying blood vessels that you see there feeding these regions of the brain, and then these connections that are so extraordinarily elaborate between portions of the brain, and that not only develop in the womb and the first year of life and the second year of life, but at least down to the third decade of life, or even fourth decade, and some, including some repair, taking place into the 60s or 70s. Next one.
And this is slide 10.
So these are some of the areas it doesn't display very well, we see a region with the circle around it that involves spatial perception. I know that it's hard for me, even as a neurologist, to think that we can reduce human beings to electricity and connections, and I'm a strong believer in Wordsworth saying that man is greater than he knows. But we do know that certain things...
Dr. Rust, I'm sorry, just so that we can orient to the slide. You're talking about the circle on the slide. This is slide 10 in section A.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's right, in section A and in section B. What you can see inside that circle, again, this is an area that's involved with face recognition. And what can be measured here is the surge of connections that take place as recognizing a face causes us to think. The more work an area of brain does, the more blood flow goes to that region. And you can see in a normal control individual on that side, you can see those yellow and red things inside the circle. That's activation of this very particular area that's involved in autism. It's abnormal. It doesn't activate. And you can see with the same face recognition task, the individual with autism on the other side doesn't have that activation. And the same can be said of other areas, and these are represented in the green here, but they include two portions of what we call the temporal lobes. If you look at the side of the brain here, this is the outside, just a drawing of the brain. The part that sticks down below there is called the temporal lobe. That has a lot to do with hearing and recognition of things we hear. And you can see two particular areas there that are characteristically involved in autism. You've got that inferior frontal gyrus that is on the same slide over on the far side. And you can see several other areas that are involved. These all have names. These all have their very particular architecture. These particular areas are different than the area next to it. They have specified functions. These are the areas that are abnormal in autism. So it is a specific syndrome There is no way in which a toxic event can produce this combination of changes. There's no way in which an inflammatory event, so far as we currently understand, can produce this combination of changes. There is a tendency of certain kinds of infections or inflammations or toxins to go to certain portions of the brain, and there is an increased vulnerability of certain portions of the brain, but this varies from individual to individual. So if you look at one brain and another brain and another brain, you'll see some similarities, but you won't see an overlap that's so dramatic as it is in autism. This overlap is seen in autistic individuals. Those lower brains represent autistic activation areas that don't activate properly. The next one. All right. So this is meant to be compared to something else in autism, or at least the injurious effects produced by organic mercury have come up here in this trial as they do elsewhere. And we do have pathology in that condition as well. I'd say at the outset that children who've been injured by large amounts of methylmercury do not have autism. They have a combination of findings that are consistent with what we call a static encephalopathy. It has its own characteristics. It's tragic when it occurs, blindness and abnormal hearing that deprive the child of sensory input that may produce to the casual observer or the untrained observer the appearance of autism, but it's far from the fact. You see as well malformation of limbs. You see injuries to brain. So the usual thing is to injure the visual cortex and the auditory cortex, vision and hearing. It usually spares the large neurons. The large neurons in the cortex are exactly those that go wrong in autism, and the small neurons are spared. These are the sensitive cells. They're the wrong ones for autism. It does not produce the same appearance clinically. You also damage not the outer laminae, the outer portion of the brain, the outer white matter, but the inner white matter and the deeper cortical laminae. This is a different pattern from what's seen in autism. It's virtually the opposite. And you injure the cerebellum, the organ that I talked about, but you injure it in a very different layer, a very different part of the cerebellum. It's the most extraordinarily complex thing, the cerebellum. And the Purkinje cells are characteristically spared. They don't get injured. It's exactly the thing that goes wrong in autism, the Purkinje cell injury. It does not happen in mercury toxicity, even in these little babies who had more mercury than anybody else, again, because it was concentrated in large quantities from their mothers into the babies, and again spared the mothers' lives because of that. Mothers that had similar burdens of mercury would survive if they were pregnant, but produce a tragically injured baby. This was all despite very uniform distribution of Dorothy Russell, that superb and marvelous neuropathologist who did these studies after Minamata Bay, carefully studied the amount of mercury you found throughout the brain. It was uniformly distributed. So it's not that you're only getting mercury one place or another. It's throughout the brain. And therefore, all of the things that could have gotten injured in autism could have gotten injured because there was plenty of mercury there to injure these other kinds of cells. Far more, extraordinarily more, 10, 12 digits more of concentration than we see from that we might see from very tiny amounts of mercury exposure. It didn't injure the areas that are involved with autism. It did injure other sensitive areas, in fact, it was difficult to get into the brain. It was less of it than in non-brain tissues. Mercury has a difficult time crossing the blood-brain barrier, brain had less than other portions of the nervous system that are outside the blood-brain barrier, so that what we call sensory ganglia that are not invested with blood-brain barrier were injured even more than the brain itself, so that the children, their limb deformities were a product of the injury to the peripheral sensory nerves. So the next one.
And this is slide 13, 12.
So in this instance, as we've suggested, we have a particular syndrome that's the product of a particular neurological process or injury. And so these children tragically had visual and hearing deficits. They had dysfunction of the central nervous system, motor system. What we know about autism is that motor functions are entirely preserved, at least in classic and regressive autism. we have impairment of function to some extent in children with some other syndromes, or at least we have some strange aspects of motor function. But one of the important things to make sure of when you're trying to diagnose autism is that the motor system is intact. It's not being used necessarily in the same way of other people, but it is quite intact. And yet we have this severe abnormality of motor systems if you injure the brain with mercury. And the peripheral sensory system I mentioned. I don't know whether there's another slide. I think there is. This is demonstrating what the greenish and reddish areas represent here are areas that are immature, becoming mature into the 20s. This slide very importantly illustrates, I think, and many of us do, with great support for this idea, that the second deterioration that occurs in higher functioning autism in the teenage years is not because of battering or bruising in life or because people are not trying hard or anything else. It's because new systems that have to come online that treat this, what we might call illness, adolescence. It's a very important kind of illness because that's where we all get our experiences, don't we? And we do things impulsively, and sometimes people convince us to go off to wars and things like that. So you perhaps wouldn't convince the 40-year-old the same readiness. These things happen 15, 20, 25 years into life where new systems come on. They may account not only for what we facetiously call the disease of adolescence, but the wonder of adolescence, and maybe the systems coming online account for what we call the feet of clay that we develop as time goes on and perhaps don't have that same enthusiasm. Next one.
Pardon me, before we go on, the slide to which you were referring with the red system is slide number 13. To proceed.
There a few other things could be said that I think are pertinent. The fact that some people have demonstrated that glutathione peroxidase and glutathione dismutase activities may be low. This is based on information in the peripheral circulation. This is important to know about because it is possible that environmental influences could have some effect on the Purkinje cell loss. So I'm not entirely excluding environmental events, but these may be the sorts of things that people naturally experience. And it may be that at least this particular system has something to do with the sensitivity of Purkinje cells. It's not fully understood yet, but we must keep an open mind about these things. Nonetheless, this is pretty good information and may have something to do with a combination of genetic sensitivity and other things that happen. It may have nothing to do with it. The next one. People are trying to look, as we know, there's a great deal now of very important information about mercury and the brain, not only what I've shown so far, but information that tells us a lot about the kinetics of mercury, a lot about its excretion. In the excellent work done in the Seychelles, the kinetics of mercury transport were worked out into a single and a double volume way of looking at these things. That's a technical term, but there are ways in which we understand how elements and medicines and other things move around in the body, there is no evidence that there is a transport difficulty with mercury. It does, as I mentioned, get excluded from the brain to some extent by blood-brain barrier, which influences the kinetics. One of the problems with kinetic studies is that when we look at a safe drug, we just give the drug to somebody and see where it gets in all the compartments. Obviously, nobody's going to do this with mercury. So these kinds of studies are dependent on knowing what the predicted mercury burden of an individual has been. It can be quite high. And as you all know, in the studies of the Inuits, where that burden might be quite high, there's no epidemiological demonstration whatsoever of a risk of the development of autism on the basis of that considerable mercury burden. Many studies that are done on mercury don't have this kind of sophisticated, careful estimation, probably most of them probably, of the burden that's ingested. There are areas into which mercury goes in the body that we call sinks, areas where it doesn't cause severe injury, usually bones, hair, and so forth. But it can be mobilized from those areas by chelation, and when that is done, we can estimate the body burden. But the chelation requires all of the excretion systems to be intact. If they're impaired or intact, you cause injury to the individual by chelating them. This has been most carefully worked out after initial bad experiences with chelation of toxic substances. It's a question of the amount of mercury that produces injury to sensitive tissues. As it is with virtually all toxins that we're aware of, some more potent than others, but in Wilson's disease, where there is a transport problem, and that's the basis of the disease, it's still the amount of copper that causes the injury. It is a dose-related effect, quite distinctly dose-related, has nothing to do with the transport process itself, except to the extent that that transport takes the copper to tissues, accumulates in those tissues, and causes injury. We know this because individuals who are fed out of copper pots, such as certain people from Japan, get their Wilson's disease earlier and have higher burdens of mercury of copper. And finally, because autoimmunity has been a career-long interest of mine, because I've reviewed this literature with particular care, there are plenty of papers. There are no markers for autoimmunity to suggest that this is an autoimmune condition. I've tried to cover the waterfront as far as central nervous system autoimmune conditions are concerned, including a forthcoming book on the subject. There is nothing to suggest currently that this is an autoimmune condition in any way.
Thank you. Doctor, based on the pathology that you have just described in detail for autism, is there any evidence that Yates autism was caused by mercury toxicity?
There's no evidence whatsoever, ma'am.
Petitioners have also put forth a hypothesis that measles virus causes autism. What are the problems with Dr. Corbier's hypothesis in this respect?
Well, as far as I can understand the hypothesis, it has to do with either effects of administration of the vaccine or with persistence of measles virus in the system causing difficulties in various portions of the body. There are a number of papers on this subject related to both the nervous system and areas outside of the nervous system. The most striking observations have, I can say with confidence, been thoroughly discredited in the medical literature and in medical communities. On the basis of the ways in which we usually thoroughly discredit things, the lack of validation, the lack of capacity to repeat the same observations, review of the tissue specimens and the techniques that were used to study those tissue specimens, demonstrating that the methods were faulty and the observations were incorrect, gathering of information from non-sequential patients, demonstrating those patients in the medical literature in ways that misrepresent the manner in which those patients were gathered, failure to misrepresent economic advantage related to publication, a wide variety of things. The medical community is relatively forgiving about some things in its community, but scientific fraud is not one of those things that we forgive. We'd be very careful before we assign that sort of thing, but there is abundant evidence that that was the case here. And it is something that we don't like because we try so very hard to do what we can for patients. We try to provide them with appropriate counseling and care. We try to provide them with an accurate explanation for why their child is afflicted with something. We try to provide appropriate therapies. We try to protect them from inappropriate therapies. We try to make sure that our parents, in trying to do something for their child about whom they understandably upset, are brought to spend money in therapies that are both expensive and potentially dangerous. So that aspect of things thoroughly discredited. Other attempts to look at this question remain and probably are some sub-areas, especially with regard to stimulation of the immune response one must consider as possibilities, but thus far no evidence, as I mentioned, in the literature to support that point of view. Insofar as persistence of virus in the central nervous system is concerned, we have a considerable understanding of this process. We understand especially what measles virus may or may not do within the nervous system. We know exactly what acute measles encephalitis is, It's a horrible illness which used to cause millions of deaths every year before vaccination. Personally, I had a friend in high school who died within 36 hours of measles encephalitis, and I've taken care of patients with measles encephalitis as well. We also worry about the possibility that folks will not be willing to vaccinate and these illnesses will return. We have measles that persists in the tissues and produces SSPE. This is especially pertinent to some argument that some measles acquired early in life might give rise to an illness that we doesn't produce the severity of early measles in terms of SSPE. We don't understand why the latency. I believe the other day it was mentioned 1 to 9 months, but that's by no means my understanding of the latency. In fact, quite characteristically, the latency is between 4 and a patient I took care of 14 years after measles in the first year of life. We understand something about why this happened, something about the inadequacy of the immune response. It's likely that the measles virus remains resident in the central nervous system. The measles virus in SSPE has been carefully studied. It has never been the A1 strain that's used for vaccine. It's always wild type, and it comes on with an illness. Once there is any suggestion of neurologic disease, the illness universally progresses to death within 3 years as a terrible illness to follow with initial behavioral manifestations that are different from those seen in autism and sometimes are misunderstood by those who take care of the child. And then we have inclusion body measles, which is another entirely different disease in no way to be confused with autism. So as far as virus resident within the nervous system is concerned, there is not one particle of information in the medical literature or in medical experience to suggest that that happened. As we try to keep an open mind, there are sometimes things that surprise us, but thus far people have gone at that with a will and have not found it to be the case.
Dr. Corbia yesterday put forth a profile of children that he believed you could determine that MMR was the cause of their autism based on a profile, and that profile was normal, then with regression, GI dysfunction, including malabsorption and diarrhea, and the onset of symptoms 1 to 9 months following vaccination. Could you please address the doctor's profile and how significant that profile is?
Well, it would cover virtually all of the children that I've taken care of with regressive autism in some way or another, although then it depends on how you define those entities. As far as normal to a child deteriorating in terms of intellectual and other functions, that covers a great many of the children that have the regressive form of autism. As I mentioned, if you look carefully prior to that time, you frequently find things that have been parents have high expectations for their children, and sometimes it's only with the careful history taking we find out that there are things that they haven't done on time, but that would cover virtually all the children that fall into the regressive category. The second portion of this was the GI complaints, is that what?
Yes.
We have a little bit of black humor in medicine from time to time, and a common saying in medicine is that one man's diarrhea is another man's constipation. It depends on what people's attention is drawn to. I'm a pediatrician as well as a neurologist. I've taken care of a great many children in my career in various settings, including emergency rooms where children come in with a complaint of diarrhea. Children get 3 to 5 bouts of diarrhea a year, quite typically, especially those that are in daycare settings, because of the transit of infectious agents in that way, viruses typically. Children also get diarrhea from non-infectious causes. The most common one is treatment of ear infections with antibiotics. That treatment with ear infections interfering with the what we call the gut flora or the kinds of bacteria that are in the gut producing diarrhea, maybe in some instances because of other effects of medication. And the medications typically used for ear infections are among those that quite commonly cause this problem. Again, it depends on how you define it. Children that have autism, sometimes have an element of anxiety, which we're still trying to work out, but we find an overlap between children that have anxiety and children that have stool retention. Stool retention producing overflow diarrhea in lesser quantities but more persistent than is seen without these large retained stools. This is another behavioral phenotype in children, and it's not limited to autism. If one were to try to make some sense of those things, one would have to perform careful, very careful epidemiological studies to find out if that is something that sets these children apart from other children, because again, it's such a common phenomenon. I believe another thing that we frequently see is again, after treatment with antibiotics, we see the adventitial development of thrush, sometimes involving both ends of the GI tract, again, because of the influence of antibiotics, I would say. So that was part two. I think those are such common things that, again, one would be making a case that all children are having a injury from something that has no basis in medical science. So what was the next part?
The last one was the 1 to 9 month period of onset following vaccination.
Well, we don't have any information upon which we can base such a judgment. But again, if one, I think an illustrative example would be the set of information that was gathered about the second DPT immunization. Those immunizations were given at 2, 4, and 6 months. And again, there are not only autism, but other conditions that develop at a certain time in the development of the nervous system, characteristically. So that not only does autism develop in the regressive form in some kind of proximity to the 12-month or the 15-month or the 18-month vaccination, but so too with an even tighter correlation, the thing that we called infantile spasms, and we still call it that. Infantile spasms is a severe seizure disorder that comes on between 4 and 6 months, characteristically right around 4 or 5 months. That's the time at which it manifests itself in most children. Because the 4-month vaccination was given, people understandably wondered whether there was a connection between the two things. Additionally, with the second pertussis vaccination, very frequently children get a local inflammatory reaction in the leg or the thigh that causes them to cry within the first 24 to 36 hours. The children don't seem to be themselves. They seem to be sleepy and restless and so forth. Then it goes away. The way to answer this question, because it was an important one, was to take away the 4-month vaccination. And the UCLA Denmark study did exactly that. They moved the second immunization to 10 months and then looked at the population frequency of infantile spasms. Infantile spasms onset at 4 to 6 months was exactly overlaying the onset prior to the immunization being moved. And it was felt by the scientific and medical community that this proved that at least in most instances, if perhaps not all, if perhaps all, that the vaccination had nothing to do with that. So we do have things that take place in the second year of life because of the working out of a genetic code. If you provide a wide range of possibilities, 1 month to 9 months, it becomes very confusing for us. In trying to sort out pertussis, we tried to get because, again, we had an open mind, we tried to get the population most likely to have a cause and effect relationship. And so we considered the children that had the onset within the first 24 to 48 hours, and we considered those children that had a behavioral change as well. And that subpopulation of patients did not change whatsoever when the 4-month vaccination was taken away. So the same thing is true of inflammatory or toxic illnesses. Proximity to the stimulus is very important as a starting point to come up with epidemiological information. For illnesses that I study that are inflammatory, we sometimes use intervals as long as 3 or 4 weeks, but not longer than that. If we were to try to associate certain kinds of brain inflammation, for example, with colds or fevers or infections, the children have 5 or 6 of those a year. So if you said it can be anything within 6 months, every single child is going to seem to have had an effect. So for vaccinations, you need to move that proximity up to within a very short interval. So one would think something like a week or 3 weeks or something like that. And such studies, I believe, have been undertaken and have not shown correlation with the onset of regressive autism. So that's the starting point, and so far no support for that point of view. Doing things otherwise leads to very untidy science, and we didn't always do science well, and we learned our lesson about doing things well, because we could waste a great deal of time with theories and other sorts of things if we didn't have rules that we followed that got us into the best possible place for coming to an accurate and honest conclusion.
And to follow up, Dr. Corbier, this profile, Dr. Corbier said, represented a genetic subset of autistic children. Is there a phenotype in autism of children that fit this profile?
No, ma'am, there is not.
Doctor, now I want to move on to petitioner's hypothesis that thimerosal-containing vaccines and, in conjunction with MMR, work in concert, a synergy that causes autism. Could you please comment on that hypothesis?
I think the word plausible was used yesterday, and I'd say there's no biologically plausible information to explain why that would happen. We know something about the potential mechanisms for either one, but thus far, when you formulate an hypothesis, you're meant to do so on the basis of a current understanding of mechanisms and trying to see what might be what. Obviously, the other approach that can be undertaken is tight epidemiological correlation between two things happening at once. If you select things that happen during an interval during which we know a disease develops, and just say maybe they're correlated, and provide a wide range of possible times at which that effect is produced, the possibility is overwhelming that the conclusion of such study will not be useful. We have to refine things further, and there isn't any plausible explanation that I'm aware of as to why these two effects taken together would produce autism. We don't know of mechanisms whereby thimerosal could produce this injury of brain. We don't know of mechanisms whereby the tiny dose that's involved, even taken over long, even sustained in the body over long intervals, could produce that effect. That kind of a theory is one that goes under the name of a homeopathic theory. Those theories are applied both to tiny amounts of substances given in treatment and tiny amounts of substances producing an effect over the long period of time. This is a theoretical construct in one branch of medicine that's not accepted by all the other branches and has not been proven, even with carefully controlled studies, to be a mechanism that in fact is valid. So that's what I'd say, I think.
And would such a hypothesis be contrary to the neuropathology of autism that you described today?
It would not be in keeping with anything I know about neuropathology.
I want to focus now on Yates-Hazlehurst and Dr. Corbier's testimony, actually Dr. Corbier's report that Yates was immune compromised. Is there any evidence in the medical records based on Yates's first 2 years of life that he was immune compromised?
Because of that question, I carefully reviewed the records that were made available to me, which struck me, I might add, as ones that were kept by a very careful pediatrician who seemed to pay attention to parents' complaints and concerns, recorded these in the chart, and all of the other sorts of things that are typically recorded in a well-run pediatric practice. The health of this young man during that interval appeared to me to be typical of young children, in no way different from perhaps the majority of other children that come into a pediatric practice. There are some children that have more ear infections than others, but this was not an overwhelmingly large number of ear infections here. Ear infections we don't recognize as something that's caused by an immunodeficiency in combination with problems in the gut and so forth, at least I don't, without other attendant circumstances. So in children that are immunocompromised, you can see these things, but together with other kinds of manifestations. None of those were present here. in children with immunocompromise or failure to thrive in association with ongoing gut problems. The first place one looks is at the growth curve of the child. The growth curves of this child had several important features that need to be paid attention to and, again, carefully recorded. And what we see is that this was a child whose growth picked up early in the first year of life and was maintained at or above the 95th percentile in weight throughout the intervals where diarrhea was recorded. This is not what one finds in a child that has ongoing gut difficulties with malabsorption or gut difficulties on the basis of immunodeficiency. This is not what one sees in a child with chronic infection due to immunodeficiency. So the growth profile was not consistent. The other interesting feature was the head growth, which increased within the first 3 to 5 months to the 70th percentile. This, of course, happens in many children, but it is something that we observe quite regularly in children with acquired autism or with regressive autism. It doesn't prove the case, but it's one more consistent feature. So I didn't see any evidence of immunocompromise whatsoever. Certainly nothing that would explain ongoing infections being in any way other than usual for children, and certainly something that would have nothing to do with the question of autoimmunity related to viruses.
Dr. Corbier also mentions the chronic lymphadenopathy that petitioners claim they felt on the swollen lymph nodes on Yates's neck.
I'm sorry,
you've published on this topic, correct?
Well, on lymph node function, the immunology of lymph nodes, that's right. Every pediatrician is familiar with the fact that lymph node swelling to a modest to moderate degree, sometimes larger, is very common in childhood. It's one of those things that we see very common. It's not an aspect of immune dysfunction. It's an aspect of normal immune function. Our studies involved trying to associate the swelling of lymph nodes with the fact that they provide a regional signal to immune responses. So we placed them, transplanted them into pedicle grafts, and provided them with stimulus from bacteria and things. And so what the lymph nodes do is if somebody gets an infection in the arm or in the neck or in the back, the regional lymph nodes swell because of the immune response. That immune response is meant to contain the microorganisms that have come to the lymph node, and so they won't spread to the rest of the body. It's meant to eliminate them, and it's meant as well to provide a regional signal, very probably, so that you can recruit additional immune cells to come to that region. That's what lymph nodes do. Because children get so many oropharyngeal infections and other infections, lymph node swelling is very common. When one is a brand new intern, when we start out, we don't know perhaps as much as we do later on, and we write these lengthy notes in our descriptions of patients, and almost all of them have the annotation shoddy, meaning like little shots and so forth, enlargement of lymph nodes, until we get sick of writing it down because it's almost always there. So that's a normal aspect of immune function.
Were there any contraindications for Yates to receive his vaccinations on February 8th, 2001?
None whatsoever, in my opinion, within a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
Dr. Corbier also relied on the 2007 article published in the New England Journal of Medicine to support his hypothesis that thimerosal-containing vaccines can cause neurodevelopmental problems. Do you agree with this assessment of the article?
I'd have to look at it. If you have a copy of it, I can make a comment.
And Special Master, can we just take a 5-minute break and then come back to that question, a 10-minute break?
We sure can. We're a little closer. We can go for... Do you have much longer, do you anticipate, on your direct?
Maybe 10 minutes,
okay.
15 minutes. So
let's do a 5-minute break, and we'll come back at 1:45. We're in recess, 5 minutes.